For those of you who were not able to join us in lab today, I have turned back the first lab exercise or lab report, and there are two different types of grades that you might have gotten. One is a point score, and the other is the score of excused. So let me explain the excuse. There were several people that, for one reason or another, didn't seem to follow the format of the lab report I had gone over in lab lecture. Or you had made some other kind of error that I really wanted you to fix first before I grade your report so that I'm giving you kind of a shot to do it over again before you get a score on it. So you will not be counted off late for resubmitting it because you're fixing things I'm asking you to. But you do need to fix those, and that's also in relationship to what you're going to be doing for lab report two. That's why I haven't released the data yet, because I wanted to make sure to go over again the lab report format, because there were lots of problems that I saw. So let me just address some of the problems in order. First, in the syllabus in the lab lecture, I thought that I had said to... I'll answer that. For those of you who don't understand, someone is asking in Russian for the answer to one of the problems, and I will say нет. So, what was I saying? Oh, yes! The syllabus and in the lab lecture, I said no handwritten lab reports, and yet some of you wrote it out and took scans of it. So, that's not an electronic lab report. That's still handwritten. And so the requirement is that you do need to produce something like what you're seeing on the screen now. I got worried enough about some of the lab reports that in a hurry this morning I tried to write my own. And so that's why I was a little bit late for lab lecture, because I wanted to add another table to this that I didn't have time to finish this morning. So you see, there's nothing handwritten there. I had also said that, yes, you could use the tables in your lab procedure as a guide, but I had also said you could not just fill those out and then turn that in as your report, because there was a certain way that I wanted you to format your calculations. The one that really got me was, even though I said don't do it, some of you still did the molar mass of a metal, even though you didn't have any data for it. So where you got that data from, I'm not sure. Or, you know, it made me wonder, are people just downloading lab reports from other people and then turning that in? But no, the numbers were changed. So that means you just weren't listening to the directions then. We didn't do that part of the experiment. Those of you who put procedure in, I said don't. So many of you had comments, but the ones that really got you, like for those of you, most of you who got the classification of excused, it is because you did it handwritten, or you didn't include the calculations, you only included the calculation tables. So please go back and look at the notes for what I'd gone over in lab lecture for how to format those. Please go back, look at the syllabus, and then turn those back in. Now, walking through the different sections of the report, here is an example that I created to show you what was sort of my thinking about how you might structure the report. First of all, since you have two sets of data, instead of presenting it in paragraph form, instead of listing it, it really makes a heck of a lot more sense to put it in a table like what you see here. You might say, Dr. Gray, why didn't you just give it to us in a table form in the first place? That was part of the whole exercise, to see what you would do with it. Little things I noticed for the... titles, you could say, mass of magnesium, volume of hydrogen. Those things, you notice I've already put the units there with the titles. Since I did, you don't have to put the units in the table itself. So you can put it one place or the other, but I actually saw several people doing both. So it's usually one or the other, and I like putting it in with the titles so you don't have to write it over and over again in the table. In the lab lecture demonstration, I had shown how to do sig figs. So, for example, the height difference was given to you not as 19, but as 19.0. So there is a way to help set the sig figs. Now, we're going to have a separate discussion of sig figs. Not that all of a sudden I'm going to become really insistent about them in general, but there's certain places in the lab report where mistakes in sig figs can actually have an impact on your value somewhat significantly. So addressing the format of the calculations, here's what I want. I want some kind of equation that's written out in symbolic form. So for example, you see pressure of hydrogen, which is equal to pressure of the surrounding atmosphere minus vapor pressure of water minus the height difference. So that's written in equation form, and in the syllabus, that's what I refer to as a prototype equation. And then I've substituted it with actual data. And in fact, if you look at the calculations heading, right below it, it says all substituted values are from trial 2. So we already know which data set I'm using. And then I come up with the final answer. And I do this for each unique set of calculations. So let me talk about some of the variations of things I saw in the lab reports. Some of you did exactly what I asked for, which is that you had the prototype equation, you had the substituted equation, but it was buried in a table. And if you just go back and look at those, that's a lot of information crammed in not necessarily the visually most satisfactory kind of way. And many of you, what I suggested is to do more like this, where the calculation examples you pull out into a separate section, and then if you look below here, you simply summarize all the results from the calculations. So you see that since all the calculation examples are for trial 2, all those exact same values show up in the table. But that's okay, because at least you can compare them to the values in trial 1. Now, if you did full calculations for both trials, it really is kind of a waste of space in a sense. Because, one, I had told you not to do that. Two, you're just repeating information that no longer is relevant. Suppose you had 10 trials. Does that mean you're going to have 10 pages worth of all the calculation examples? No. You only need to include one set of example calculations. And then, like I've done here, you could tabulate everything together. Let's see, things not related to significant figures. Yes, this one I did ding people for, because I had talked about it extensively in the lab lecture. It's part of the whole reason we did the whole discussion of a height of a column of liquid and what the difference would be if it was water versus mercury. And if you look at the pressure of hydrogen calculation there, I have pressure of hydrogen is pressure surrounding atmosphere minus vapor pressure of water minus the pressure due to the height difference. So I had warned you all repeatedly that equation is not in your lab text, even though it should be, because some instructors do it exactly the way I do it. And there is actually a section in your data table to put that height difference in. Why the equation's left out is just one of those small corrections I need to suggest that gets made. But the point is that in lab lecture, I had discussed that you need that height correction. And many of you left that height correction out of your trial 2 calculations. Now, let me see, what else here? Percent error. This is something I noticed later in grading, which is some of you were using absolute signs. Remember that, please, I want you to report percent error as the number itself, meaning that if in this case the true value ends up being too low, that you are reporting it as a negative percent error, and if the value ends up too high, that you report it as a positive percent error. Now, let me just look one more time over this to see if there's something else. Again, I'm going to come to significant figures momentarily. But I think I addressed all the major errors I saw. There were just a couple of people, I believe, that used first person. A couple of you took my suggestion of using variables, but you use so many variables that all it was math and no English, no text. So just like I've done here for the calculations, it wouldn't hurt to label what the calculation is. So these are the sample calculations listed here. Yes, and I'm going to clean up this document a little bit more, make it a little more what I would do for style. This is what I did in a rush before the first lab this morning after I finished grading that section's lab reports. So I had literally half an hour to do most of this, and then the second table I just plopped in right before this lab lecture. So now let's get to a discussion of significant figures. Let's have a brief, focused discussion of significant figures. And what I would like to do is an example of where addition occurs, so we can talk about the rules of addition, and a place where multiplication or division occurs, and so we could talk about that separate set of rules. So first one's going to be a very simple calculation, which is the temperature of hydrogen in Kelvin. So what is the prototype equation for that? Well, it's degrees Celsius plus a constant, which for reasons will become clear momentarily, I'm going to use the value of 273.2. And in the case of the lab this morning, the lab report, one of the sets of data had 22.6 as the Celsius temperature. So how would we do that addition in terms of sig fig? Well, let's see the math lined up here. I'm going to expand out the constant for Kelvin, and I'm going to put 273.15, which is its more precise value. I was just reading about definitions of Kelvin earlier this morning, just to see about constants. So we'll see why in a minute why I use the 273.2. But let's take this more expanded value, and now I'm going to add to it the 22.6 that was one of the measurements. And of course, if we wanted to add those together, we handle each column separately, and I get 295.75 initially. Now here's the point of what we're going to talk about, the rules of addition or subtraction. Since subtraction is just negative addition, it's all about what we don't know. So if we look at this, 22.6, there's something here, the next digit beyond the 6, that's going to end up adding with the 5. But we don't know what it is. And so that means that digit underneath where I have the 5 in the answer, we don't really know if it's a 5 or not. It could literally be anything depending what the question mark is. Out on the other side of these numbers, in front of the 22, well, that's really just a 0 that's sitting there. I mean, it can't help it's the fact that it's a small number. So it's just a placeholder that doesn't even have any real purpose. It just doesn't, there's nothing there to worry about. There's no uncertainty. So in the rules of addition or subtraction, if you have any digits where you're uncertain, then you drop those digits from the answer. Or to cheat and look at the wording I came up with this morning, in addition or subtraction, any uncertain digit being added or subtracted makes the same digit in the answer not significant. And so what I'm going to do is drop that 5. Now, because that first digit being dropped is itself 5, that means we're going to round the previous number up. So if the first digit dropped, is greater than or equal to 5. The previous digit is rounded up. So that means in this case that 295.75 is going to turn into 295.8. So later on, when you look at the sample lab report again, you'll see that's the version of the number that I used. Now let's return back to this 273.2 issue. All of your temperatures were measured with one digit past the decimal point, which means any temperature you want to convert to Kelvin would technically undergo exactly the same issue, where if you added the 0.15 in, then where the 5 is, that digit is going to be uncertain. And so that means in any temperature you convert, that digit would automatically drop, and which means any number that you report is automatically going to have that last digit rounded up 1. And so since you have one digit after the decimal point in all of your measurements, that's why I use one digit past the decimal in my constant. So since all temperature measurements only have one digit past the decimal point, the constant 273.2 is used. And again, that is because of that one digit past the decimal. And yes, once I'm happy with the example lab report, I'm going to post it. I just wasn't finished in time before this lecture in order to be able to send it out. Now, another calculation that is similarly affected by sig figs is the calculation of the pressure of hydrogen, because you're subtracting out two values. And as far as what will limit it, it's your barometric pressure, because there's only one digit past the decimal. Now, if you really did learn sig figs at some point, you know that in an operation like this, you'd take all the numbers you'd given, you'd do the subtraction, and then you'd worry about the sig figs after. So even in my example, I believe I carried a couple extra sig figs, which then dropped out at the end based off of the atmospheric pressure. Questions about the addition or subtraction example of sig figs? And sig figs will be over soon, don't worry. Okay, then moving on. Our next example is a multiplication example. And before I do the example itself, let me just talk about why multiplication is different. And so I came up with the very easy problem of 27.9 times... Excuse me, 0.012. So if we multiply all that out, we get, 855-0972-8433. Yes, and then we've got 1, 2, 3, 4 digits right of the decimals and the numbers we're multiplying, so we got 4 digits in our Yeah. Well, you know, us old people, there's a comment coming in. Those people who grew up with times tables and weren't allowed to use calculators for things, we can do some of our math more quickly. So, in multiplication, every digit interacts with every digit. What's the point of saying that? Well, in addition, in a subtraction, you're just doing straight up and down one column. It's not all the digits that interact with each other. So why you do what you do for addition is different. Here, since every number interacts with every other number, here's the rules. How did I say that before? Rules of multiplication and division. The number being multiplied or divided with the least number of sig figs determines the number of sig figs in the answer. So in this example, how many sig figs does the top number have? Well, since the instructor circled, it's probably pretty obvious, isn't it? 3. How much does the bottom number have? 2, that's right. So that means that in this number, I should only keep 0.33. Questions? Oh, well, then what's the real life example? Moles of hydrogen. Because moles of hydrogen end up being equal to moles of magnesium, which would be the mass of magnesium divided by the molar mass of magnesium, which in one of the examples was 0.0441 grams, divided by what? Well, technically, you could divide it by 24.305 grams per mole. But there's only 3 sig figs in the number up above here. So it would be okay if you only used the 3 sig figs here. You should not use just the number 24. You should use at least the number of sig figs that you have in the number that you're going to be having on the top of the fraction. Now, any questions about sig figs, or would we like to move on?
Can I see the first page again?
All right. I'm not going to remember. I'm not taking screenshots. So give me honestly, how many of you
read the book?
Read the lab. How many of you actually read over the green. Wow. I know. But you know, this morning, a bunch of hands went up. Come on, you can raise your hands.
Oh,
man. I'm so very disappointed. Oh, dear. Okay, well, you all like doing it the fun way, don't you? Well, I'm going to take it slow today anyways, because it turns out it took me long enough just to get through the essentials that we didn't get anywhere near as far through the lab as I thought I was going to. So you all can kind of luck out on this one. This is what is affectionately known as the Green Crystal Lab. Or the Green Salt. And it is an example of what is known as a transition metal complex. So you're in Chem 1B yet. I mean, you're in Chem 1B, so you have not had the chemistry yet that I'm thinking of, because in Chem 1C, we talk extensively about transition metal complexes. So once you've taken 1C, the following example is going to make more sense, but there is a relatively simple example I can describe, and it involves the substance silver nitrate. Now, in terms of lab safety, anybody know anything about silver nitrate? Like, why to be careful with it? Well, if you get it on your hands, it stains your skin. It oxidizes your skin and turns it colors. And that color won't wash out until it's essentially that your skin grows out. And if you get it on your clothes, it can ruin your clothes. So you want to be careful with silver nitrate solutions next quarter in Chem 1C if you take it when we actually have a campus open again. So what would happen if you took silver nitrate and reacted it with sodium chloride?
Silver chloride.
That's right. It precipitates and makes silver chloride. Now, I'm seeing in the chat window some questions. So I was saying green crystals, and someone says, can we make the blue crystals, man? And no, you have to take organic chemistry for that. You don't make meth in general chemistry. That's organic chemistry. And then what else? How else could we figure out the procedure? For the lab, you mean? Oh, you mean for rounding? Ah, because in this... Okay, so sorry, let me back up. Someone's asking about the previous calculation that ended in 0.33. The reason it does not end up as 0.34 is that first digit afterwards is less than 5. So if it's less than 5, we leave the previous digit alone. Sorry, I missed that before. And then, what about the potassium oxalate monohydrate? Getting there! You're getting ahead of me here. So, silver nitrate reacts with sodium chloride to make silver chloride, which I forget if that's a grayish, whitish powder that falls apart in light to make a purple substance. I think that's the color change that undergoes. Made it years and years ago. And then we're going to have a byproduct, which is sodium nitrate. Now, if you could not remember that this precipitation was going to occur, then you want to study up a little bit before you get to Chem 1C, because there's a lot of discussion of solubility in the labs. One of the labs involves an awful lot of solubility. So you're going to want to go back and look over your solubility rules. Now, the reason I mentioned the silver nitrate and then the silver chloride is because next quarter, you're going to do this thing called qualitative analysis, which is where you do some simple tests to get color change or other things to occur to try to identify what's in a sample. Yes, so as some of you are discovering, some of my organic students were interested in hearing about the Green Crystal Lab again, so they're actually listening in. So they've had the 1C, so they know what I'm talking about here. But one of these tests is going to involve this. There are other ions besides silver that could precipitate with chlorine. And just in case you don't remember them, that's the mercury 1 and the lead 2 ions. So what if you had a sample that precipitated when you add chloride to it. It could, in theory, be one of those three compounds. But it turns out you can pull a trick, which is you can cause the silver chloride to dissolve again. Not by itself, but by adding in another reagent. And that's ammonia, which is neutral. Now, ammonia is a Bronsted-Lowry base. Silver chloride doesn't look like any kind of acid that you'd recognize. But it ends up being what would be called a Lewis acid. And it forms this. This is that transition metal complex that I mentioned earlier. Because you have these bits of molecules that have attached to the silver. Is the screen frozen? Yes, it is. Sorry, I didn't realize that. One moment. Oh, and I forgot. I knew a quick way to get out of that. I have to remember to do that. Sure is behaving better than the other day, though. All right. So, in the brackets, what the brackets mean is that is a complex ion. So that is an ion created by the combination of two or more ions or molecules. Ammonia is neutral. And if you look at it, that means that it has no effect on the silver's charge because there's only one chloride that goes along with this. And so that means the ion itself is just a single positive charge still. So this complex has the same charge as silver itself. Since the ammonia molecule is attached, are neutral. So the whole point is that this complex allows silver to be soluble in the presence of chloride. Which would normally not be able to do. I have a request to back up. I'll show you the previous page in just a moment. But last thing I want to do on this page is to define a term that you're going to see in the future, which is a ligand. And that is an ion or molecule that attaches to the central atom in a complex. And in one C, you'll learn all about different types of complexes, different types of ligands, different ways that they can interact with the central ion. All we need to know now is just the term ligand, so I can show you this green salt that you're going to make. Now, just to give you another example of where the term ligand's used, I think just a couple of days ago I was talking about the process of respiration, taking in oxygen and having it go through the bloodstream. And I was talking about that because it's an example of a reversible reaction. Well, in this example, there are iron centers in hemoglobin that would be the centers of these complexes. And oxygen would be the ligand that is able to attach and then later on detach itself. So we won't go much into ligands this quarter because that's a 1C topic. But at least now we have the introductory terminology to talk about the Green Salt Lab. Here we are. So, the green salt is made from two different substances. First, iron 3, chloride, hexahydrate. So, nomenclature. It's one of those things that I get a little fussy about sometimes because, you know, talking about all these language examples in the break. Suppose you're in a foreign country and you don't know something like street or house or bathroom. That gets very inconvenient. So there's just certain terminologies you really need to know. So same thing in chemistry. You got to know what an iron 2 is versus an iron 3. What does iron 3 mean? Silence.
The charge is plus 3?
The charge is plus 3. So if the charge is plus 3, and chloride automatically is a negative 1 charge, that means we're going to need 3 chlorides in order to make a neutral structure. Hexahydrate, that means this thing is a hydrate, and that's what the dot there in between means, that it's a hydrate. Now, I didn't tell the story this morning because I think I was running even more out of time, but the dot is used in other circumstances as well, where you can, in fact, if you look at the back of some of your medications, it may have blah, 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 dot HCl on it, which means one molecule of HCl associated with whatever becomes before it. Maybe when we hit acid-based chemistry, I'll talk more about this notation there. But does anybody know what a hydrate is then?
A substance with water in it?
No and yes. It's more exact than that. Because you could just say something's wet and that's got water. But it's a substance containing a fixed number of moles of water. Oh. As part of its molecular structure. So the classic 1A example is copper sulfate pentahydrate, bright, pretty blue substance that when you heat the snot out of it, get rid of all the water, you're left with this kind of whitish, grayish powder. And it turns out if you pour that into water, it gets the water back and turns blue again. But that's not just a physical change, therefore, that's a chemical change. And that means the water forms part of the structure of the compound. So that's why I put the emphasis there. Now, the other substance is potassium oxalate monohydrate. Oxalate is an organic ion. And just to remind you, with something written in line structure format like this, the unlabeled positions, those are carbons. So this formula would have the substance would have the formula K2C2O4.H2O. And here's what's going to occur. We're going to take the iron 3 chloride hexahydrate, react it with potassium oxalate, monohydrate, and they're going to form two substances. One of them is KCl, byproduct, which will remain soluble. Potassium is a group 1 ion, always remains soluble. Chloride is normally soluble, and especially if it's with a group 1 ion. So what's left over? A salt. That I'm going to copy the book's way of writing the formula. So KW, iron X, oxalate Y, dot Z waters. What is the point of this formula? Well, that's the point of the lab. We're going to do, if we were in there in real life, different forms of analysis to come up with what W, X, Y, and Z are. Now, the ones we directly measure in real life are X, Y, and Z, and then we go calculate W from that. But what's X? Well, that's related to what's in the center of this complex, so I'll just call that the central atom here. The Y, that's related to oxalate, which that's our ligand. So the X and Y together give us our stoichiometry of the ligand versus the central atom or atoms. That whole thing forms the complex anion. And it's got to be an anion, which means, well, I don't know, I don't want to give anything away. It's got to be an anion because you have potassium with it. Potassium is a cation. Now, one thing I did not have time to verify is whether it is necessary to have potassium for this whole lab to work, or whether potassium may just be a counter ion, which has a very nice set of matching chairs. No, a counter ion is what? It's a spectator ion. Used to balance charge. What does that mean? Well, spectator, the point of that is to say that it doesn't matter what the ion is. Like a spectator in a precipitation reaction, it's just something floating around, doesn't really get involved in the reaction. So there's not a reaction here per se. We've already made the product, but the point is this. You can't isolate just an anion out of the mixture. There has to be a positive that goes with the negative. So my wondering is, could this whole thing possibly work if it was the sodium version instead? And I don't happen to know. But that's why I wanted to at least bring up the term counter ion, because I'm going to use that term in the future. So there is the synthesis of the substance. Now please go ahead and take your screenshots and we'll move on to the next portion of the lab, because the lab's broken up into days and parts, and the days and parts don't match necessarily. Part one is synthesis of the compound, which that's what this is here, mixing these two solutions together, and boom, out comes a precipitate. So part two, which is what I'd like to do next, is purification of that precipitate, which we do by recrystallization. Now I'm going to give you a real-life example of recrystallization to help this make sense. Anybody out there ever made rock candy? Okay, a couple of people. Well, if you haven't, you've probably seen it before, at least, at amusement parks or something like that. And if you've never made it, here's the way you do it. You get some water and you heat it up and you add sugar. And then you add sugar. And then you add sugar. And after that, then you add sugar. And anybody that's ever made it knows what I'm talking about. Because you take this little pot of water and you're pouring all the sugar and it's like, how can all that sugar go in that water? Well, sugar is covered with OH groups, alcohol groups, makes it very chemically compatible with water, loves the stuff. So you can keep adding sugar as long as the temperature's hot. And see, that's the thing, you'd heat it and stir it, but you don't really want to boil it because You need to dissolve it, which means you need to add water. But if you boiled it, you'd be removing water. So you heat stir, add, heat stir, add. And you get it to the point where it just finally can't take any more sugar anymore. And then you let it gently cool down. Because of the fact that water is so compatible with sugar, if you don't disturb the mixture, when it cools down, the sugar stays in solution. The reason that's notable is that solubility of solids goes up in solution as temperature goes up. It goes down as temperature goes down, which means the sugar should fall out of solution. But it doesn't if you do it, if you don't disturb the solution. Then what you can do is you take a piece of string or something, dip it into the solution, and that disturbs it. And that causes the start of the process of crystallization. And thermodynamics happens, and the whole thing starts to crystallize. And you end up with this chunk of sugar on your string, which you pull out of the solution, and that's your rock candy. Okay, now what's the recrystallization part? Let's say that you had pepper mixed in with your sugar. I can't recall, but I don't visualize pepper being, ground black pepper at least, being soluble in water. I see it floating above pasta, for example. So, what if you put the sugar and the pepper together in the water? Heated it up. The pepper's going to stay there. The sugar dissolves. You could even do one trick better then. Filter it really quickly before the sugar crystallizes. Then let it crystallize, and you got rid of the pepper. That's recrystallization. Recrystallization is a purification technique. In which a substance is dissolved. Then allowed to crystallize again. Leaving impurities behind in solution. Now, we're not going to go in deep detail of this since we're not doing it in real life. But I want to explain why the procedure is written the way it is written. And that's due to the fact that in most real-life situations, see, let me say this. The reason that you heat up the solution is because the solubility increases, right? And then the solubility decreases once it cools back down again. But what if the solubility doesn't actually go all the way to zero? Well, that means you're going to have some of your solute left behind, which means you're going to be missing some product. Not all of it will recrystallize out. So in any real recrystallization, there is the chance that product may remain soluble. Or I'll say, the chance the substance may remain soluble even once the temperature is reduced. To prevent loss of product, a minimum quantity of solvent should be used. So that's what we do. You have water that you heat up in a separate container. You then have your sample that's in the other container. The sample precipitated in water, but at higher temperatures, it will dissolve in water. So you don't want to add your sample to the water and have it maybe disappear and totally get lost forever. You add the water a little bit at the time to the sample, and then that way you can get it to just barely the point where it all dissolves, and you stop adding the water, you cool it down, and let it crystallize. And in fact, most cases, after it cools down to room temperature, then you put it in an ice bath to make it cool down even further. Now, this morning, I asked, and there were a couple people that had not either heard of or didn't remember. They were unsure of what Hirsch filtration was. And so let me write that out really quickly here. Wait, I'm drawing that wrong. Try again. There we go. So Erlenmeyer flask. That has what's called a sidearm, which doesn't mean they're packing heat. It means it's got something sticking out the side there. And that is connected to vacuum, which in our labs we are fortunate to have a permanent vacuum system. Inside of that, you then put the Hirsch funnel. Where if you look at that funnel from up above, it's got a bunch of openings in the bottom. So what you would normally do is you would cover that with some kind of filter paper. And to make a better connection, actually, there's usually some kind of rubber adapter. That would go between the Hirsch funnel and the flask itself. So you put the funnel on there, you put the filter paper on there, pour your solution out. If you do it carefully, the liquid portion would come through and your solids would be left on the Hirsch funnel. Okay. So we have just enough time to talk about the first analysis that you would do, which is a redox titration. So this is going to be for the analysis of oxalate. And a statement I'll start with is that oxalate can easily, the technical word is, decarboxylate. Oxalate can easily decarboxylate under heat or oxidation. And so you're going to do a reaction where you take permanganate and you're going to add it to a mixture of your green salt. And it will react with the oxalate ion under acidic conditions. If you look back at the structure of oxalate, it has CO2 groups connected to it. They are connected to each other. So imagine those get split apart and you end up producing two molecules of carbon dioxide. So that's exactly what's going to go on here. Your products are going to end up being the manganese ion, manganese 2 ion, Those split up oxalates will form carbon dioxide gas, and then a byproduct ends up being water. So, since this is a redox reaction, let me ask you, what is the oxidation state of manganese in this compound?
+7?
That's right. And the way he got that is that the entire ion has to add up to -1. We have 4 oxygens, each which is a -2. So oxygen would contribute -8. But we only end up with -1. So the only way to get that is if manganese is +7. And so if we look at it, that means manganese goes from +7 to +2. And so that means it is reduced. And so that means that permanganate was the oxidizing agent. Which makes sense. That's what potassium permanganate is usually used for, to oxidize something. Now, in oxalate, what is the oxidation state of carbon there?
-2. I mean, it is oxidized.
It is, but I'm asking what's the numbers. And it turns out it's +3 to start with and +4 at the end. Same logic. If you have 2 carbons that are +3, that gives you +6. But if you have 4 oxygens that are -2, that gives you -8. 6 minus 8 gives you the overall -2. So in this case, carbon went from +3 to +4. And so yes, that does mean it did get oxidized, because if something else got reduced, something has to get oxidized. And it means oxalate was the reducing agent. So remember, oxalate is the thing that we're trying to test for. We're doing a redox titration with this manganate. Now, permanganate. In a titration, there are 2 different points that you reach. One is the equivalence point. The other is the end point. So what is the equivalence point? And I'm going to push us on because we're running out of time. It is the reaction of equal moles adjusted for stoichiometry. I say adjusted for stoichiometry because exactly like in this reaction, when you totally have balanced this reaction out, you should have reacted 2 moles of permanganate, 5 moles of oxalate. That's not equal, but it's correct based on stoichiometry. So it's reaction of equal moles adjusted for stoichiometry. Then there's the end point. And the difference is that the end point is the visual observation of the end of the titration. Which usually means a color change. Now, why are these 2 things different? Well, here's what occurs. The end point of this reaction is the appearance of the purple color of permanganate. permanganate has a very characteristic purple color to it. But that permanganate will only appear once you've gotten rid of all the oxalate. To push the point further, that means you already passed the equivalence point. You already reacted with all the oxalate. And now you have a little excess, which is why the color occurs. So the color occurs because excess permanganate is present. But if the titration is stopped at the last drop, the endpoint closely matches the equivalence point. So in other words, in a well-designed titration, the difference between the two is small enough, we don't worry about it.
Any sense of base 5? Got it.
So let me wrap this one up by quickly writing the equation out again. So we had two permanganates reacting with 5 oxalates in an acidic environment. And I don't even really need to show the products, because the point is there is a 2-to-5 ratio between the permanganate and the oxalate. So to put that in English first, at the equivalence point, there are 2 moles of permanganate reacted for every 5 moles of oxalate. So translating into math, you can translate it 2 ways. One is to write what I just said in the form of a ratio. And that would be 2 moles permanganate versus 5 moles oxalate. But that's a ratio. That's counting numbers. That's not the way that we use it in a mathematical equation. In an equation, you have to multiply things. So we would say 5 times the moles of permanganate equals 2 times the moles of carbonate or oxalate. And I know I'm going to get someone asking, saying, wait, why'd the numbers switch? Well, think about it. Let's say you had 4 moles permanganate. In a balanced reaction, that means you would have used 10 moles of oxalate. So if you stick 4 in for the left-hand side of the equation, 10 in on the right side, you find out that the equation works. And it's just, again, because of the way that you represent a ratio versus representing an equation. So the whole point is that if we wanted to find out how much oxalate is around, we could rewrite this, because there's the molarity of oxalate. Molarity of permanganate times the volume of permanganate is going to equal 2 times the molarity of oxalate times the volume of oxalate. So the volumes, those get measured. That's what you measure in a titration. The oxalate we are looking for, that means the permanganate we have to know, and we do. It's given, and in fact, it's supposedly standardized. And so the goal of this whole thing is to come up with the concentration of oxalate. There'd be a little bit more to do to get the answer we need for the formula, the overall goal, but we'll cover that some other time.